Hello and welcome to this new episode of Viewpoints. Boris Chassaigne here with you for the next half hour. On today's show, February is Black History Month and we'll have a great story for you. Canada Post honors Marianne Shad, an activist, publisher, lawyer, teacher and journalist who was influential in the Underground Railroad movement. A new stamp was revealed in honor of her accomplishments. One of her descendants shares her excitement with us.
She became the first Canadian woman and the first Black woman in North America to start a newspaper. And this is an incredible thing for someone to do in the 1850s. You know, at first she had to hide the fact that she was a woman publishing this newspaper, but eventually she came out and admitted that it was her and said, "We have broken the editorial ice." And of course, after that, she went on to do many other incredible things, too many to list, but my favorite is that she went back to school and became a lawyer at the age of 60.
Ottawa CAF's international student permits changes will mainly affect BC, Quebec, and Ontario. We'll turn to British Columbia to see what it means for the University of the Fraser Valley. And to Ontario, the Ludmilla Art Gallery, which focuses on women artists, closes its doors. The owner feels people just can't seem to afford luxury art anymore. Welcome to Viewpoints Local News Nationwide.
Follow us on X at Canada LJI and listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks for keeping us company, and we'll try to make it worth your while by kicking off the show with a great story as we lean into Black History Month. And a great piece of history we have for you as Canada Post revealed on January 23rd a new stamp in honor of Marianne Shad. Who is Marianne Shad? Well, she was the first Black woman in North America and the first woman in Canada to edit and publish a newspaper, the Provincial Freeman. But that's not all. She was also a teacher, lawyer, abolitionist, and an activist who made her mark in history, and all this in the 1800s. Shad, a Windsorite, won multiple awards and has been recognized in many ways for her role in Black history, with this stamp adding to that collection. Her descendants today are passionate in their own missions on Black history as well. One of those descendants is Irene Moore Davis, president of the Essex County Black Historical Research Society. Journalist Aisha Meehan is in Windsor, Ontario. She met with Irene Moore Davis about the unveiling of the Marianne Shad stamp, but first she talked with Canada Post spokesperson, Director of Equity, Diversity and Inclusion, who says Marianne Shad continuously defied expectations not only for gender, but for people of color and all women as well.
Canada Post spokesperson Brandy Ryan, Director of Equity, Diversity and Inclusion, shared her comments about why Canada Post chose to commemorate Marianne Shad.
Marianne Shad was chosen to be honored by a stamp because of her incredible impact and legacy on Canada's history. She was an incredible woman. She was an abolitionist, an educator, a lawyer, and an activist. And she dedicated herself to the advancement of Black people, women, and equality for all people. She also contributed greatly to education in Canada. So she continuously defied expectations not only for her gender, but also for people of color. She launched her own newspaper in 1853 at a time when women were not welcome to do so. In fact, she was the first Black woman in North America and the first woman in Canada to edit and publish her own newspaper. And that newspaper, the Provincial Freeman, was well received by many people. She advocated for people to come to Canada, and she advocated for freedom and for education. So those are some of the reasons why we are so pleased to honor Marianne Shad.
Today, her descendants continue to make their mark on Canada, one of those descendants being Irene Moore Davis. On January 25th, CJM spoke to Irene Moore Davis about Marianne Shad and how it feels to have her be commemorated in this way.
That has been very exciting for the Shad family, but it's also been just very exciting for a lot of Canadians who are deeply interested in Black history, in women's history, and in the story of this particular phenomenal woman. So Marianne Shad is someone who actually lived in Windsor, and that's another really cool component, that a woman from Windsor is on a Canadian postage stamp. So Marianne Shad came here in 1851 specifically because she wanted to assist the refugees from slavery who were coming across in large numbers at that point to Windsor. She became the first person to open up an integrated school in Windsor in 1851. She then wrote a book, and she's one of the very first women in Canada, let alone Black women in Canada, to write a book, and that was called A Plea for Emigration. She was trying to tell people why it was worthwhile and important to make their way here, even if they were free people of African descent, why this was a better place to live. She then opened up a newspaper in 1853, the Provincial Freeman. And when she did that, she became the first Canadian woman and the first Black woman in North America to start a newspaper. And this is an incredible thing for someone to do in the 1850s. You know, at first she had to hide the fact that she was a woman publishing this newspaper. She just used initials. But eventually she came out and admitted that it was her and said, "We have broken the editorial ice." And of course, after that, she went on to do many other incredible things, too many to list. But my favorite is that she went back to school and became a lawyer at the age of 60 and practiced civil rights law in the U.S. and tried to help underprivileged people attain their legal rights. So just an incredible woman. And it's just so great to see her being honored this way.
What is your relation to Marianne Shad exactly? Like, how far back in the family tree is she?
So Marianne Shad is the great, 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 great aunt of me. She was the older sister of my great, great, great grandmother, Elizabeth Shad Shreve. And Marianne Shad is the great, 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 or great, 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 great aunt of a lot of people in southwestern Ontario, as well as in places nearby like Michigan. So there are many Shad descendants. But, you know, she is an incredible person, and it's so wonderful to see her recognized in this way. For a long time, she was kind of like our family's best-kept secret, or someone who was really only studied by people who really researched Underground Railroad-era history or abolitionism. But she's been gradually becoming better known, and now as a result of being on this Canada postage stamp that's being released to great fanfare, hopefully she will be someone that more people know about this year.
So was her name one that was well remembered in your family specifically, or did it take a while for even your family to realize who she was and what her connection was to Black history?
I mean, I think there's no single answer to that because there are really hundreds of Shad descendants around. Mm-hmm. In my particular family, we had a particular tradition of really sharing our family history. And so in my family, in which I grew up, my branch of the family, we really did focus on her, and we focused on her siblings as well and their exploits and other members of the family through the generations who had done amazing things, because in my particular branch of the family, that was a way to motivate and inspire ourselves to keep going and to keep pushing for change and to recognize that we come from some pretty cool people. But I hear from other distant Shad relatives, as recently as this week, that when they were growing up, they didn't hear about Marianne Shad Carey, that they learned about her in adulthood or whatever. Doesn't matter when we hear about her, though. I think that once somebody gets a hold of that story of Marianne Shad Carey, you just can't help being inspired.
For the process of making the Marianne Shad stamp, did Canada Post reach out to your family, or did your family maybe reach out to them? How did that happen?
So the proposal to actually bring forward a stamp came from a distant relative of mine, and that was really wonderful. So many thanks to her for submitting that proposal to Canada Post and doing the research to, you know, meet their standards and make sure that they had all the boxes ticked and so on. And so once that took place and once Canada Post had decided that they were going to proceed with the Marianne Shad Carey stamp, then last year, Canada Post did reach out to some representatives of the Shad family, including me, and allowed us secretly to see some sample designs and make some decisions. They provided us with quite a long list of potential stamp designs. We voted on them, each of us who had been asked to take a look. We were people who are Shad descendants, but who also have some knowledge of the history. And so once that happened, then we were given a short list and asked to rank those. And honestly, I didn't know until Tuesday at the official unveiling ceremony in Chatham which of those top three the stamp was going to be. So it was really exciting to see which one got chosen. And I'm very happy that it's the one that got chosen. It is a stamp that presents her looking forward, looking determined, but it presents her in 19th century clothing, mid-19th century clothing, looking like a woman of her time. There were some other designs that were very beautiful and very imaginative, but they were maybe a little too imaginative, if you know what I mean. So it was nice that this actually represents her, but it also really conveys her spirit and her vision.
You kind of touched upon this already, but how does it feel for you personally to know that she's being commemorated like this?
It's very exciting, but I mean, it's exciting for me mostly because as someone who has education and history as primary love, aside from literature, I'm just happy that more people are going to learn about her, that more kids and more teachers and more just ordinary Canadians of all kinds will at least have some sort of sense that this woman existed and what she did and why she's being honored in this way. Stamps are one way that we tell our culture, we tell our cultural story, we tell our country's history, and we kind of comment on what's important to us and what we value. We don't put someone on a postage stamp if they don't represent the values that we as Canadians hold dear. So I think it's really special that she is being recognized in this way. Mary Ann Stad Carey has had no shortage of recognition. She's a person of national historic significance in Canada with her own national historic plaque. She has a provincial heritage plaque. Her newspaper, the Provincial Freeman, has its own heritage plaque. She's got the full-length, beautiful sculpture here in Windsor at the University of Windsor, thanks to the artist Donna Main. She has a post office named after her in Delaware, where she was born. Her final house, where she lived in Washington, D.C., is a National Historic Landmark. She's been inducted into the Women's Hall of Fame in the U.S., like all of those kinds of things. She had a Google Doodle on her 197th birthday. But those things, as helpful as they are not quite the same as having a postage stamp. And I think it's just wonderful that she's going to be someone that a bunch of people will have in their home. They will actually have these stamps in their homes. They will put her on letters and cards, and I think it's just wonderful. I always send out holiday cards, and this year I'm going to send out even more because I just can't wait to put her face on all of them. I do want to share one other thing that might be kind of interest. You know, other than King George and the late Queen Elizabeth, Mary Ann Stad and her father, Abraham Doris Stad, are the very first father-daughter duo ever in Canadian history to both have Canadian postage stamps in their likeness. So it's a very special honor for our family indeed. It was so nice to be at the unveiling with many, many Stad descendants and just to see the joy and the pride in everyone's faces. We know how important she was and all the incredible things she did, but it's just so nice that so many more people will learn about her now. It's always been fascinating to me how few people learn about Mary Ann Stad Carey in school. Hopefully that's going to change a little bit now. But for the last several years, she has been part of the Canadian citizenship exam. So it's interesting when I go and I give Black History presentations at the local agencies that serve new Canadians and so on, many of them have heard of Mary Ann Stad Carey because she's in part of the learning resources when you're studying for your Canadian citizenship exam. So people from overseas are learning about her to an extent that Canadian-born people who have gone through the whole school system here often have not.
Irene Moore Davis expressed how she felt her ancestor, Mary Ann Stad, was a remarkable woman who truly made her mark on Black history. She shared how she was extremely excited and grateful that Mary Ann Stad is now one of the Canadian stamps. The new stamp itself was released on January 23rd in Chatham, Ontario by Canada Post. The stamp was designed by Underline Studio and illustrated by Natasha Cunningham. This story was brought to you by the Local Journalism Initiative of Canada. You can hear the full episode on frequencynews.ca.
That was journalist Aisha Meehan. Welcome to the LGI team, Aisha, and thanks for this great story.
You're on the air with Viewpoints.
Well, we've been hearing a lot in the news about the federal government's cap on international student permits, a measure that could hurt not only the students themselves and their families, but post-secondary institutions as well. The cap will be set at approximately 360,000 people approved study permits, a decrease of 35% from 2023. It is unclear how the change will affect post-secondary institutions in British Columbia, Ontario, and Quebec, for example. example. In a press release, the federal government stated that it will allot a portion of the total to each province and territory, weighted by the population. Journalist Charles Brockman in Abbotsford, British Columbia, spoke with Satwinder Kaur Bains, associate professor and the director of the South Asian Institute at the University of the Fraser Valley, about the cultural context of the change and further support that governments and institutions could provide to international students.
Dr. Bains, will this change affect UFE?
I think there is going to be a great impact. I can imagine that, you know, we've had a reliance on international education and students for a while. The government's bid to cap the numbers of students coming from, as international students from wherever in the world, is going to affect us as well, because we won't be able to just willy-nilly take whoever we want, because there were no caps and there was no regulations in terms of managing both the numbers as well as the fee structure. It sits outside the provincial mandate in advanced education, so that is going to make a bit of an effect, because the government has also said that students have to deposit now double what they were depositing before they got here. So I think it's going to be, price will be one, the cost of doing education abroad, and two will be the cap that government's going to put on.
40% of all international students granted permits in Canada come from India, more than any other country in the world. One of your many roles at UFE is advisor for Canada-India relations. Have you heard of any diplomatic response from the country of India?
I haven't seen a lot on the Indian scene. I've just seen some of the newspapers, like Hindustan Times, Indian Times, reporting what Canada is doing. But there hasn't been this great hue and cry from the Foreign Ministry or the Ministry of Education or External Affairs about this, because I think they see the numbers as quite small compared to their population. So it's going to affect certain regions. I think what you would probably want to see is a response by the governments of the state, like Punjab and Maharashtra and the Union Territory, them coming up and saying, now what? You know, if this pipeline dries up, then what do we have to provide for those people who are going to stay behind and access our education system and then get gainful employment from that?
The federal government has stated that this is part of an effort to deter bad actors in the international recruitment process and mitigate exploitation of the students. Do you believe that?
So I think these are really welcome initiatives by the government to control this burgeoning industry that has had challenges and had rotten apples. And, you know, we as a country, I think we have the tools and the wherewithal to fix that. I don't think it's insurmountable. It's something we should fix. And I'm glad at this bold step that the government has taken.
Can you elaborate on that? Would you say your connections within the Indian diaspora living here in Canada feel mostly the same way?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, all the circles that I'm in and we talk about these things, you know, they said some measures had to be put in place. There was like a free-for-all, you know, it had, there were no bounds and boundaries. Initially, there were, if you remember, in the early 2000s, you know, you brought students in at a very high GPA, so you accepted students from, had good grades. But what's happened is that the numbers, the entry-level numbers have dropped significantly. And anybody who wants to go at 17, 18-year-old is coming abroad. And one of the challenges we're, as a subcultural diaspora in Canada, are noticing is that they're very young and they're the same age as domestic students, but their access to decision-making is much lower. So they have never worked outside the home. They are not mature in terms of handling finances or running a household or managing on their own. They are struggling. And we've seen that here. You know, people have supported them, but I know they survive and they get through that hump and they come out at the other end and they're better for it, probably. But it is a challenge for somebody who is, they become more and more insular. They tend to hang out with their own kind. You know, they go and work for a person that looks like them. And is that what Canada really wants to do? Like, do we not want students who become integrated into society at a high level and do well? Nothing wrong with having your culture and ethnicity and original language, all that, you should maintain that. But we also want a more pluralistic society that understands, you know, at one side, we have this immigration policy that for us is an economic policy that wants to bring people in to help us grow as a country. But on the other side, we haven't put in those kind of support systems for them to really feel as part of a Canadian society.
Are there other steps you would like to see taken to protect international students?
So lots of examples of what we could do and support students. I think one of the biggest ones is to do pre-orientation before they arrive, whether it's online or whether it's in person. But we're able to do that. If you have 700 students, someone should be touching base with those 700 kids. They're coming here without knowing where they're coming or who they need to talk to. People, students have arrived here with suitcases at the university looking for someone to help them find a place to live.
Whose responsibility should that be? The federal government, provincial, or UFE?
The federal government can only cap certain things because education is a provincial mandate. They can cap what they've done. They'll do what they can. But then the province has to be a willing partner. And I think it will be. I think all provinces want to have a better understanding and a better outcome from internationalization. And I think as a campus, we need to internationalize truly, not just say the words, but we need to, all of us need to be understanding of what these students bring with them and how we benefit from their, both their finances, but also their efforts. I don't think we have a true understanding of that.
Thanks to Dr. Satwinder Kaur-Bains. We'll be keeping an eye on this story as it progresses and as it relates to BC and UFE. This story was made possible by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. For this story and more like it, please visit frequencynews.ca.
Thanks to Charles Brockman and welcome also to the LGI team. So student visa caps will make newcomers think twice about coming to Canada, according to immigration lawyer Vivian Albuquerque. Federal Immigration Minister Mark Miller announced cuts to the International Student Visa Program, but also cuts to work permits for spouses of international students. Montreal immigration lawyer and former international student Vivian Albuquerque says she feels these are careless measures. The cuts will mainly affect provinces like BC and Ontario with higher numbers of international students. Quebec with fewer foreign students could take in more. Details on that with Katie Brady in Montreal, Quebec. Find her story on frequencynews.ca.
You're listening to Viewpoints with Boris Sasang.
Well, it's the end of the road for the Ludmilla Art Gallery. The gallery, which opened in 2019, closed its doors on February 2nd. For the past 5 years, the Ludmilla Gallery, located in the Commerce Building in downtown Peterborough, Ontario, was a commercial art gallery with a focus on female regional artists, says ex-owner Laurel Palick. Palick's goal was to prioritize female artists who are working outside of larger cities. She noticed that sales had been really dropping since November 2022, having some shows without a single sale. This was unusual for Ludmilla Gallery and made it clear to Palick that more people are unable to purchase luxury art. Laurel Palick spoke with Edward Sweeney about the gallery, the closure, and its 5 years of operation.
This February marks the end of a five-year journey for Peterborough-based interdisciplinary artist Laurel Palick, owner of the Ludmilla Art Gallery, which will be closing at the end of the month.
And Ludmilla Gallery is a gallery. It's a commercial gallery. Not that I really wanted it to be that way, but that's just the reality, with a focus on female regional artists. So that is what I'm very much interested in. I really believe that female regional artists who are sort of away from the larger cities, sort of away from that kind of competition and influence. These women have sort of found their space, found their voices in their practice, and I want to know what they have to say. So that's the reason behind Ludmilla Gallery.
Palick opened the Ludmilla Gallery, located in the Commerce Building in downtown Peterborough, in February of 2019, and has made the decision to close the gallery after a decline in business and a change in how people consume art.
You know, really, I think since November of 2022, I've noticed sales were really dropping. I think the new economic situation that we're living in here in Canada has really made it very difficult for the sort of people I know. You know, the people I know are sort of regular people, you know, who, you know, have to pay mortgages or pay rent or buy food and don't have an excess of cash, you know, so it's been hard. So I've had some amazing shows. Most notably, I think in that November was a woman named Alice Olson Williams, who's an incredible quilter. And her work, she prices it very low. And she's quite a renowned artist. And I realized that, you know, we didn't sell a lot. And that was sort of a bell that rang for me then. So I carried on. And I had a few shows this year where there were no sales. And that's really rare. That's been very rare in the 5 years. So it's just it's just become harder and harder to survive as a commercial gallery. But I sort of realized that the writing was on the wall, that right now art purchases are not the topmost of people's mind. So really, you know, I'm sort of a part of what we're seeing now. We're seeing restaurants closing. We're seeing stores closing. So I'm a sort of a part of that. The culling of the luxuries in our lives.
The conversation with Palak, initially focused on the closure of the gallery, quickly changed focus to more of a reflection of the past 5 years. And I wanted to know what kinds of challenges she's encountered.
I've had so many artists come. I was booked, almost 2025 was booked up. So the challenge is being polite and letting people know that I have a bit of a vision. I had a bit of a vision on who I was wanting to represent. So, yeah, I think one of the challenging things were, I don't know how to say this politely. I would have a lot of men come into the gallery and, you know, I'd have to say, you know, that I wasn't interested in their art because I was really focusing on female work and their behaviors and their attitudes really, really sort of solidified why I really want to work with women and not necessarily the typical sort of cisgendered white male.
I also asked if Palak had a favorite artist or art installation that was displayed at the Ludmilla Gallery, and though she could not pick a favorite, there were some highlights.
You know, the one that there's an artist in town named Carolyn Code whose show was going to open on March 2020, right when we literally had 1 week, and she does really interesting installation work, and I love her work. In this case, she had a big papier-mâché pink structure that was about maybe 2 by 3 feet that was against the wall, and it had these pink discs radiating off of it. It was a beautiful, it was a great installation piece, and it sort of looked like a virus. It looked like a nose sneezing in many ways. That was kind of a little prescient and unusual and strange and wonderful, and I always sort of regretted that people really weren't able to see that show.
And though the Ludmilla Gallery is closing, Palak was a prominent figure in the Peterborough arts community before its opening, and will continue to be afterwards, as they find a way to engage with art in a way that is better suited to the community's needs and wants.
Well, I think, you know, I also teach a lot, or I facilitate art a lot with kids and go into schools, and I think it's really... It's kind of radical in an anti-capitalist way, I think, to create things instead of buy things. I think it's great for our mental health to feel that we're connected to our own emotions, that we're expressing them, that we're even exploring them. I think it makes I think the arts, both creating and enjoying them, just makes us wholer people. We're just better rounded. We're well rounded. We're able to sort of connect to things like our empathy and our critical thinking, these things that make us an interesting species to be, you know, on the planet. You know, some years ago, I started something called the Alley Waltzes, where I'd take theater outside and bring people to see these different plays, these performances, and I loved it. And at the time, it was sort of a response to how expensive renting theaters could be and how we were sort of lacking in those venues. So I think I've got some plans up my sleeve come July.
And we wish you all the best, Laurel Palak. And this completes this edition of Viewpoints, thanks to the newest additions to our LJI team, Aisha Mayan in Windsor, Katie Brady in Montreal, Charles Brockman, and veteran Edward Sweeney. Our national editors were Victoria Fenner and Maureen McEwen. Thanks for your help this week. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada with the precious help of this radio station. I'm Boris Chassagne, your host and producer. It was nice to have you with us this week. And until the next, ciao.
Listening to Viewpoints. Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.